there. That's funny. I didn't expect to see that. But yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, I have relationships today. I'm looking out at different people here, and it's, I, you know, I'm not nervous. I have a higher power. You know, I hope my higher power doesn't find it fit to embarrass me or show me some humility tonight. But there's awesome people on Zoom that I just saw the other day on at our committee elections. I'm on the Bucks County Young People, and we won the conference. So the Pennsylvania State Conference of Young People is coming to Bucks County. And that's why I just laughed, because I just saw Tony and we were just talking. You know, and then I'm looking at Terry here. He comes to New Dawn. That's my home group. I usually like put rocks on his chair, or, you know, we're always like, we usually take our socks off and our shoes, and we're, you know, like we're grounding ourselves and have some great conversations with Mike. Mike's a super spiritual guy. When I really need some advice, when no one else is really giving the advice that I need, I go to Mike, and I usually get a resentment because he usually tells me things I don't want to hear. But I guess I've been in a good space because I haven't called him in a while. Maybe I should call him a little more often. But yeah, it's just beautiful. God is blessing us with this beautiful weather. I'm just happy to be sober. Oh, and my wife. I met my wife in the rooms, and she came out to support me. So, yeah, let's talk about some alcohol, huh? I got sober October 14, 2010, when I was introduced to the rooms. I stayed, so I've been sober throughout. I did the suggestions, and I got the results. So I'll just quickly go over, you know, what it was like. I know it's got to speak for a little bit, so hopefully I can get some good messages from God and a higher power. But I did pray, I did meditate. You know, when I'm feared up, I ask God to, you know, please remove that fear so I can be a maximum service to others. That's one thing I learned, and I got quiet, you know, because I have an ego, and I want to be liked. I want to be heard! I guess you guys can hear me better. So when I was younger, you know, my dad, the story starts with my dad, you know, where I'm sitting on his lap in front of a fireplace, you know, I'm like, wow, this is my dad, he's such a great guy. He got us this beautiful home, this beautiful fireplace, and he's smoking something, and it's just a really funny smell. I'm too young to really know what it is, but I just kind of put that in the back of my head, you know. And I remember looking at some old VHS tapes, and, you know, we went to the beach, and in every part of the video, he had a beer on, you know. So he's smoking with me, you know, on his lap, you know, he's drinking whenever we go places. He would take me to the American Legion and give me some quarters and a knife and say, go play. And this was in New Jersey. I got sober in New Jersey. You know, Perth Amboy, New Jersey isn't the best area, but he needed a drink and, you know, he needed to do something with me. So I remember one time it was snowing out and I wanted to ask him, like, hey, did you want to play in the snow with me? But I knew I couldn't. I was too afraid to ask him. So that's when he gave me the knife. And I cut myself. And I knew I couldn't say anything because he would yell at me. And so, again, I don't know. I just realized, you know, cold and ice. And I just kind of, like, put the ice on my wound. And, you know, that's kind of the story of me growing up. He told me that he would take me on drug runs because he didn't think the cops would pull over somebody with a kid in the car. And I remember being in just really sordid places, funny posters on the wall, you know, just knowing in my gut something wasn't right. I loved playing this triple beam bounce. You know, this was in the 80s, so that was part of my childhood. And then lastly, he liked to drink a lot and beat my mom up, so the cops were at the house a lot. One memory I remember, you know, really vividly, as if I, like, dissociated and was looking at myself as a kid. I was so scared to the bone, I was chattering. And the cop looked at me and said, this kid is, like, frightened to the bone, you know, just literally teeth chattering. And, you know, that was my exposure to my dad and his alcoholism. And it didn't really ever get better. You know, another childhood memory is him coming home, hearing cabinets banging, things being thrown around. I'd go upstairs, and for a long time, whenever I heard a cabinet bang, I would associate that with, like, trouble. You know, something's coming. My hypervigilance would come up. And at a certain point, my mom would whisk my sister and I to grandma's house, And, you know, he's drunk, he would call up and, you know, I think I even remember him yelling over the phone, I'm going to kill you all. So, you know, I just had this innate fear in me from a young age. And, you know, when I found alcohol and booze, it quickly shut that off. And as a matter of fact, the drinking started, so they got a divorce around when I was 10, and he moved in with his father from Edison, New Jersey. And that's where I started drinking on a regular basis. When I would go there on the weekends, he would, my uncles would come over. So the alcoholism goes far in my family. My dad's dad, my grandfather, had killed his wife in a drunken driving car accident. She was 21 and pregnant. He was drinking at a wedding and he flipped the car. And as a result, he remarried somebody that was like 30 years younger than him, which was actually his, my dad's, like someone in my dad's friend group, which is really weird when you think about it. And then, is that funny?
No, not the thrill.
Okay. They had kids, and they were my age. So I actually had an uncle that was younger than me. So I had an uncle that was 1 year younger, 2 years, 3 and 4 years. And the one that was 4 years, young, older, would be partying at the apartment that they had. And so I was just like a young kid watching. And when I was growing up, my dad always gave me beer, and I hated the taste. So I needed to come up with a way to get drunk. And my first plan to get drunk at that place was we used to play roller hockey on the little cul-de-sac there. And it was a summer night, you know, I didn't drink any water at all. And I swore to myself when I get up to the apartment, all I'm going to drink is beer. And it happened. I had that experience. It was phenomenal. I cried. I let emotion out. I remember going up to my dad and putting my arm around him, like, "Dad, I love you. You know, you're the man." And it's funny that I say this now because, you know, I have 11 years. We were playing Sega Genesis, and there was this awesome game, Mega Bomberman. I don't know if anyone remembers it. I do. And I just loved playing it drunk. It was just a fabulous feeling, and you know, no repercussions or anything. At that time, it was just happiness, and so that's where I started drinking. You know, it was like a New Year's, and you know, again, my uncles are a little older than me. They're talking about lighting Sambuca on fire and trying to take a shot. You know, I remember doing that, and it just was a great time, and it was a way for me to get outside myself. I didn't have to think anymore. You know, I mentioned that hypervigilance that was innately in me, you know, instilled in me. I always had to know, have an escape route. I always had to have options, you know, in my house. I've also done some other work, some ACA work, and some of this kind of comes into play. I remember being at a meeting, and actually it was here. It was a Thursday night meeting here. They have a pool table, and when I was growing up, we had a pool table in the basement, and in my head I said, if anything ever happens here, if a bad guy ever comes, I can crawl up right in that, under the pool table and no one ever sees me. And that's like a kind of weird thing to foreshadow, you know, I was always afraid of something going to happen. And then once I had that thought, I was thinking, oh, when we were in the mall, and this could have been just me being playful, I'd always, I would climb up in the middle of the clothes racks, because you could hang out there, and you know, if anything ever went down. But it's just interesting, as a kid, you know, not being safe. But all that went away when I put alcohol in me, you know. So it didn't start very fast. You know, some Zambuca shots, you know, some beer. But I remember that feeling, and I love the feeling. You know, and since day one, I never didn't drink to get drunk. It was not an option. I just never occurred to me. And so, you know, I was 12 when that happened, those shots and that kind of thing. When I got into high school, you know, that's where my drinking picked up. Since I had those experiences, you know, I put in my back pocket and, I was gonna, you know, the next time that I can expose my friends or, you know, have that happen, you know, I would. And, you know, having a sleepover in like, you know, freshman high school, again, I wasn't hooked on alcohol, but I wanted its effects. And so there was, like a schnapps, like an apple schnapps. And like, I know that can get you drunk. So I put it in like ice cream and you know, it didn't get me drunk, but it's just funny the things I was starting to do to get that relief that alcohol would give me. And then the drunk that I had with my friends in high school, we got 240s amongst three of us, and the same thing happened, you know, it was that bright light experience of freedom, you know, that head rush and that, just not thinking anymore, you know, just when your head is always going, that's pretty exhausting. And when you find something that can stop that and it feels good, you want to do that more often. You know, drinking in high school was on the weekends. We had our spot in the woods. I don't know if anyone else had a spot in the woods. You know, we put up a tent. We had we took a toilet that was laying on the side of the road. We brought it back there. It was like our little spot. And we would just get drunk and we liked collecting all the beers, you know. We had an area where all the cans were, and even when it was cold we were drinking, you know, we used to get a bottle of Absolut, and you know, just that was my high school. We also took pictures of everything. You know, this was pretty much before social media, because we knew we wanted to have a really cool yearbook, you know. We had 4-page spread of nothing but us getting drunk. You know, and they had to edit it, so they put little teddy bears on all our drinking things, you know, that was our big goal in high school. But I did have some issues in high school. So I talked about being innately afraid of life, people, and everything. But when I get drunk, I become, you know, a big mouth. You know, I say what I want to say, and I usually try to say the most vicious thing I could that I know is going to hurt you. One night, my buddy, we were just drinking, and he was seeing someone, lady on the football team he should have been seeing, and they were having a verbal conversation on the phone, and I took the phone away from him and said, you know, this is where we're at, come see us, you know, let's go. And they did, and just got my ass kicked really bad. You know, remember seeing a lot of stars, you know, being kicked on the ground. My girlfriend at the time tried to break up the fight, and she tore her ACL. She was a field hockey player at the time. And I got my ass kicked. The next day, tried to take a shower to get the blood off me, but you know, everything's so sore, it's hard to wash your head when there's bumps and bruises all over yourself. And then I had to make sure I clean up the blood on the stoop before her parents came home. And I don't know, for a long time I thought I was a badge of honor, you know, I'm a badass. But upon doing some step work, I learned, well, my sponsor told me that I only got my ass kicked. I never threw a punch in a fight. I was always too drunk to consider taking a punch at somebody. And, the years go on. I'm 21. I get a DUI. And, you know, it's sort of like a story where when I got into recovery, I looked back on it. I was like, okay, I should have seen or learned something there. And, I had aspirations of building a bar in my house. And, you know, the parties were always at my house. My dad had a keg, or allowed us to party there. And we'd always get a keg and, you know, we can do whatever we want. And I made a bar. I built this nice bar out of, salvage materials. And, we had a poker table. Texas Hold'em was really big back then. And I was painting the ceiling lime green because I thought that was a really cool color. And so my buddy calls me up around 3 in the afternoon. Let's get a few drinks. It's nice out. It's the summer. So I'm like, all right, that's cool. You know, don't take a shower. You know, still have paint on me, with flip-flops and, and so that's probably 21. In 5 years, I'll learn about the phenomenon of craving. But, you know, I seriously intentioned on just going to get a few so I can go back to painting and, drink a few shots and, it's off to the races and it's just go hard and fast. That's just, that's just what happens. And, we bar hop a little bit and again, the beer muscles came out and, started running my mouth and got kicked out of the bar. You know, it's pretty hazy exactly what happened, but someone followed us to White Castle, and we got our ass kicked in a White Castle. I remember seeing him towards the side, on the ground, and I was on the ground. And again, I don't know if you can relate, but when you get kicked on the ground, you just see stars all over the place. And for whatever reason, my head was telling me, get back up, get back up. And I kept getting back up, and the guy's like, dude, stop getting up. I don't want to hit you. And so after that, I jumped in my car, I drove away, and then the cops got me not too far away. I'm just a coward, really, to be quite honest with you. You know, I would never stand up for myself and cause trouble when I wasn't drunk, but alcohol, you know, did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And, you know, I was so much of a coward that when I got in the jail cell, I started crying. And I brought up, so this was in Cranford, New Jersey, I brought up my buddy who was just recently killed in Afghanistan, and tried to name drop him to get out of alcohol, you know, being locked up. And the next morning was terrible. My head, you know, just... I had rules when I was drinking, you know. One of them was don't drink in the morning, but if you're drinking through the night into the morning, that doesn't count. Another one was you can't drink the next day because that would make you an alcoholic. So I just made rules to avoid seeing the truth. And I, you know, alcohol again was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And, you know, the years go by. My bottom is, you know, again, I wasn't meaning to go out and have a crazy, terrible time. My buddy was like at a wedding that he wasn't having fun at. And in New Jersey, we usually take the train to New York. We drink on the train, get nice and, you know, lit up a little bit. And something happened. I black out, and I just kind of come to in a hallway. I remember there being red carpet. Don't know how I got in that hallway. It turns out we took the train back to Jersey City, which again is not a great area. And I just kind of come to, and I look at the ground, and I'm like, oh, this is a really red carpet. And I see the walls. It's narrow. And at this point, I'm just so drunk and out of my mind that I just crash. And like, I didn't care that I had my wallet on me. I just needed, you know, I just passed out. And then, you know, at some point I wake up and just, you know, the headache and the nausea is terrible. But I look outside, my buddy's on the lounge chair outside. So it turns out he didn't have his keys, so we couldn't get in the apartment. I stumble outside and, you know, I'm puking up all over the place. Try to get some water at a local spot, and the cops come because they said a guy like me shouldn't be in that neighborhood. And they're like, "What are you doing?" They searched me. I didn't have anything on me, and I call my dad and say, "Pick me up. I'm under this underpass in Jersey City." And you know, he comes to pick me up, and he doesn't yell at me. He's just, "Oh, okay, you got drunk. You have to be in Jersey City. Cool." You know. But yeah, that was my drinking history. You know, just the same thing over and over again. You know, I had rules of, you know, I won't drink this night, I'll drink water between, like I was working out back then, and I was like, whenever I drink protein shake, I tend to throw up, so I'm not going to drink protein shake, but it was also like pizza, and I don't know, it always got out of hand, you know, it just never went well, but I loved it, I loved every second of it, I loved not knowing what was going to happen next, and I was always the guy who's up late, I was always the guy, you know, the show off guy. I remember like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I saw this guy at a party, you know, I'm sober, drinking, and he was just a douche. And I just saw myself, and I was so embarrassed and livid. Like, that was me, you know, being the loud mouth, you know, the center attention guy. It really disturbed me. But, you know, let's get sober now. So I'm 26, I'm going to Rutgers, and, you know, my life is just hard. You know, it's hard to drink all the time. And I wasn't an every single day drinker, you know, but the days started happening, you know, more frequently. You know, it turned into, you know, it was Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday, sometimes Monday, but then it was like a Thursday, you know, then it was just, you know, it just, I noticed that was happening, and that was picking up. And I also noticed when I got drunk, I started to crave other things, and that was a problem too. You know, but some of those other things I didn't love as much as alcohol. I love the mixture, I love that feeling, but alcohol is just the go-to, you know. So yeah, life is just depression and drinking and waking up, and my hangover cure is to be in a fetal position on in the shower with the water as hot as I can stand and just puking up bile and yellow stuff from the night before. And somehow I know there's a center at Rutgers where it was the first school in the nation to have a recovery house. So they do a lot of recovery work with the students, and I call up and, you know, I tell them where I'm at, and, you know, the story goes, I'm trying to be a little honest here, and I say, you know, how much do you drink? And I didn't want to tell the truth, but I also wanted to kind of say that I was drinking, you know, probably more than I should, but I thought 8 to 10 beers a night was like not an alarm. And it was really way more than that in other things. But for them, that was an alarm. And so they said, oh, why don't you come in? We can do an intake. And, you know, I do this thing on the computer and, you know, I get the results and just, you know, basically says you're an alcoholic. Has alcohol affected your family? Has alcohol or drugs affected, you know, your work life? You know, have you isolated? All this stuff. And of course it's yes, yes, yes. Have you ever got trouble with the law? Of course, you know. Has it hurt you or other people? Yeah, plenty of times. And so the counselor asked me, hey, why don't you go to an AA meeting? There was a Monday night at Rutgers, and I was like, sure, you know. This was probably early October 2010. And so I go, it was a speaker meeting. Yeah, everyone was happy, and I listened. I listened pretty intently, and everything that was said, I related to. I understood, you know, nothing was scary or different. But being that innately scared person, I just left as soon as possible. So I fulfilled my obligation, but I left, you know, right after the meeting until the next week. You know, I tell her, and she said, why don't you, like, just stay a little, you know, go early, leave late sort of deal. And so I did, and, you know, someone talks to me, and, you know, they give me a number, and, you know, back then, guys give me a number. It's, like, a little weird, like, I don't know you like that. And, you know, I don't know that that's called fellowship. You know, I don't know what that's called 12-step work. I don't know what that's called one guy trying to stay sober, you know, for himself that night. And that started my journey. You know, the guy said, what meeting are you going to tomorrow? And I didn't consider that. And so I went to my second meeting. And, at this point, you know, I was trying to be honest, you know. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I wanted a solution. And so we go to meetings, and, you know, I'm not scared of meetings, which is pretty cool, you know. I start to meet people, and I get my first sponsor, this guy Dan, who's a Rutgers alumni. And, you know, he's kind of busy in his life. You know, he just graduated, he's got a fiance. I do remember going over his house. He must have read the doctor's opinion. And, you know, I just started being a part of AA. So I had my sponsor, I got a home group. I started making coffee, and what that did for me was just get me acclimated, you know, coming to meetings, a habit of going to meetings, didn't know I was being of service, I just thought I was making coffee. You know, they always say, you know, if a newcomer comes, I don't know if a newcomer came, but, you know, I knew I was there, and I fulfilled that obligation, and I got to meet people in the home group, you know, I got to have conversations, and so, you know, I had those early boxes checked. In Jersey, they really push the 90 and 90, even though that's not necessary, you know, in our literature. But, you know, I was like, this 90-90 is pretty crazy. Like, 90 meetings, that's like, I have things to do. I'm going to Rutgers at the time. Initially, I thought that was crazy, but I do this 90 and 90, and again, it just gets me, oh, it opens me up. You know, it opens me up to have an experience. And, just because I had a little willingness, you know, I remember getting my 30-day shift, my 60-day shift, my 90-day shift, and it was sort of astonishing, that I am not drinking for this amount of time in a row. My previous record was 4 months without AA of going, without a drink. And there was always plenty of stints. I'm swearing it off forever. I'm never doing this again. Side note, I was a streaker when I drank, all by myself, which is really embarrassing. I would throw plates down and break. I just did stupid stuff all the time. And I'm getting a solution. You know, I'm going to meetings, I'm listening, got a sponsor. My first hurdle in AA was to get a new sponsor because it just wasn't working out. And so, you know, what did I do? I asked people in the rooms, you know, what do I do here? And, you know, one thing I heard is have a sponsor before you get rid of your sponsor. And you're not married to anybody. You know, it's just another man walking this journey with you. And so the guy that I was thinking about, you know, asking to be a sponsor was just a guy who had confidence. You know, he talked with a certain ability. You know, he had solution. I guess that's basically it. And it was, I'm pretty sure it was a Sunday night. It was a 9 o'clock meeting, so it was probably around 10 o'clock. And I asked him, and I don't know if it was before or after, but he said, you know, how long do you want to be sick? And you know, I was ready. I was ready for a solution. And so he's like, all right, you have a big book. and I must have forgotten one at the time. You know, so he sets up a time to meet, bring a pen, bring a highlighter, and, you know, we meet at a place in Rutgers, and, you know, the first thing he has me do is tell my story, you know, basically what I just told you, and I wanted to, hopefully, I wanted him to qualify me out of AA, because I didn't think I was all that bad. But he related, you know, he said the same things I said, he felt the same way I felt, you know, not the same exact story. So I was like, okay. And then, you know, one time, this guy's name is Big Book Tim, by the way. He hasn't actually spoke here, years ago, I think. Was it him? I think it was him. So we open up the big book and there's nothing on the front cover. He's like, this is what you know about the cover. No. You know, and we go, we start from the prefaces, and we go through the book, and we learn things. You know, we learn about alcoholism. And I loved every second of it, because it was all, you know, he said, this book's about you. That's what he would say. And then another big line he would have is, on page 113, the first three words, that's the secret to recovery right there. And I guess I'll let you guys find out what that is if you don't know. But I was actually on a Zoom meeting, and then there's even more to that. There's another page where you go to a second page, and it says even more. I forgot to ask what the guy said, but, you know, we start going through the book. And one time I was late and he left and I was like, wow, I was like 5 or 10 minutes late. He's like, you gotta be accountable. If we said we're gonna be somewhere, we're gonna be somewhere. And you know, I react to that like, don't you know who I am? Like, why are you so serious? And, you know, the reason why he did that is because, you know, we're not acting the way we used to act. You know, it's, AA is about unlearning. We have to unlearn all that stuff that we thought suited us. And going through the book, you know, Doc's opinion, and you know, he tells me why I'm an alcoholic. You know, there's this allergy that I have that separates me from others. You know, normal people, if you will, will take a sip or two or a few cups of alcohol, wine, what have you, get a certain feeling, and their brain says, "Wow, this is probably not good. I should probably stop there." And there's none of that for me. You know, I get a taste and I get a feeling like, wow, let's do more of that. And my body, when I put it in me, craves more. If you've listened to Joe and Charlie before, they kind of get into some of the scientific aspect of it, and I haven't looked up any of it recently, but, you know, I want more. So that's one thing that separates me from non-alcoholics. When I put it in me, you know, I don't know when I'm gonna stop. And that's been my experience. You know, it's always been my experience. As I, you know, mentioned earlier, I never even considered stopping. So that's like the funny thing. I thought about that, you know, in recovery. Like, it never even occurred to me that you should stop. The whole point was to get drunk. You know, drinking for effect, as the book says. You know, so I learned about that, and you know, he has me write down, you know, to threefold disease. You know, the allergy, you know, the mental blank spot, and ultimately this spiritual sickness that I have. You know, what I had learned is that I was going to the wrong spirits. You know, alcohol is a spirit. I didn't know I was seeking a different spirit all along. You know, a higher power. And that's one thing he told me, you know. My responsibility as a higher power is put your hand in God's hand. And we do that by going through this book. And, you know, we continue the reading and, you know, how am I powerless over alcohol in all these ways, which I kind of, you know, talked about. You know, the roles that I would engage in and different things, you know. You might be an alcoholic if you change brands or, you know, you don't hang out with these people because you're drinking one too many times, they think you're crazy, you know. So it just related to everything. And so when it came to step one, like, I can see I was powerless. You know, I mentioned that big 4-month stint that I was able to do that I was really proud of myself of not drinking on my own. And, you know, had a little mental blank spot where someone suggested having a glass of wine. I forget everything that happens, all the craziness, all the torn ACLs and swollen heads and, you know, hot showers, and maybe it'll be different this time. And my sister said, you know, let's have a glass of wine, and I do, and maybe a week goes by, and at a certain point, I drink the way I always drink, hard and fast. That's just the way it is. And then there starts the, you know, I'm just off to the races. You know, and so, yeah, that powerlessness right there, and unmanageability. You know, I was always scared, I was always depressed, I was always something, you know. Life was always a melodrama of some sort. And I try to use books, self-help books, you know, everything but a program, a higher power to get sober. You know, how could my solution be my problem? It didn't even occur to me. I didn't even realize that I was alcoholic, you know. There was a certain time in recovery where I sort of had this, I guess, clarity where it was almost as if the alcohol chose me and was using me as a vessel for itself to get drunk. You know, that's like the power of it, the cunning, baffling power. I had no idea, you know. I just thought I was a good drunk, you know. I just thought I could party hard. But when you think about it in those terms, it's kind of scary, you know. It took over. And so yeah, step one wasn't hard for me. I believe I took it out there. You know, I came in and I just wanted a solution. Fortunately, and I got it. 3 months into the program, 4 months is when I started going through the steps. And you know, I've seen psychiatrists and all that stuff my whole life. I've always been depressed, but I was in a really bad depression. I don't know if it coincided with you know, getting sober. I was starting a 4-step then. But I was, you know, had a lot of suicidal ideations. You know, I was doing architecture at Rutgers and horror studios, you know, very rigorous curriculum, at least for me. A lot of not sleeping, a lot of hours in the studio, like I said. And, you know, I'm trying to do this grading work. And I can't show anyone that I'm afraid. That's like my number one rule. And I'm like freaking out in my head because I can't figure out these numbers. And I can't go to a teacher, I can't ask for help because that's just weak, and I don't do that. And I kind of look up and I see myself, like, I have this vision of myself hanging in like blue, you know, at my desk. And I'm like, ah, oh, it's weird, you know. And I'm driving along, there's a few bridges on Route 18 over there, and I'm just like, I don't want to stop, I just want to go up to the bridge. And then there's this smokestack, I remember saying, I just want to be at the bottom of that smokestack. Like, I don't know how I'm going to get there. I was like, oh, I'll get a grappling hook, I just want to, you know, I wanted to jump in, like, just crazy things, you know? And this is a pretty good early on God experience. I told my sponsor, he had dealt with the same stuff. He had gone to the same facility for people to deal with that. And he said, the advice that he gave me was pray to God. And I wasn't really doing much at that time, because I was pretty new to the program. But the pain was so great that I tried it, and it was before that home group. I probably made the coffee. I went down to another room because I didn't want to see anyone. Or I didn't want anyone to see what I was doing. And I just, I kneeled down on a table and I said, God, I have no idea what's going on here. I'm not thinking good thoughts. I don't want to drink, but I don't want to be alive right now. You know, and I went to the meeting as usual, and I found myself at the psychiatrist's office, and you could just see it in my face. I wasn't there. There wasn't a human there. And she's like, we gotta send you somewhere. So the ambulance comes. And not that I was in a comatose state, but I just felt like that. Like, I didn't care what was gonna happen, you know? A brick could fall, a house could fall on me. I didn't care. I was just so in a dark place. And, you know, at that time I was like, I felt terrible that I had to go inpatient for 7 days. But it was what I needed. And, I brought my big book. And I got better. You know, I got the help that I needed. You know, and as a result, I know what it's like to, you know, be watched when you shave. You know, I know what it's like to not have cords on your hoodies. You know, I remember doing, learning chess from a doctor who was in there too. You know, started doing a little like workout thing, and, a cool story that happened when I was in there, you know, because I was so, couldn't show fear and couldn't let people see the true me, I stopped being able to feel emotion almost, and like I stopped being able to cry, and it's a really tough place to be, to not be able to let emotion out. And I had this experience there where there was someone else, you know, a young lady that was there, and you know, she was interested in me, and you know, I decided not to pull any punches, but I ended up writing her a letter, just a really honest, really beautiful letter, you know, like, you're a good person, you know, and hopefully you can find, you know, what I found. Because I was starting to have my spiritual experience, and I gave it to her. And, you know, nothing happened, but I went to the, you know, I did my daily with my doctor, And I told him, and I just started crying so hard, because it was just a sincere, pure motive act of not wanting to get anything from somebody else. And yeah, it was an ugly cry in front of a doctor. And it felt great. And the lesson that I learned there was, when you hold stuff in, it's not good, you know? And kind of, you know, that's a good point to jump right to the fourth step, but you know, I realized it was a higher power. I threw that higher power out because it seemed like anyone else I was hanging out with and partying with wasn't using it, so why do I need to? Didn't see me working then. So I had to believe in something, you know. It wasn't hard to come to believe in that. But through reading the book, I knew that I could, you know, give my life to this thing. I believed enough in it, you know. And so when it comes to the fourth step, I was able to release all that darkness. I was able to bring light into the darkness, you know. And for me, it's almost as if all the garbage is in front of this door. You know, that leads to my higher power. And I'm not going to be able to see that until I do the work. And, you know, fears, I had plenty of them. I knew what they were. I thought about them every day. Resentment, same thing. Thought about them every day. And, you know, he showed me how to do a four-step, you know, right through the book. He prints out some pages, there's columns, you know, first column, you know, who am I resentful of? You know, second column, you know, why? You know, what parts of self did it affect? Yeah, of course my emotional security. I'm a sensitive guy, you know. Ambitions, sex relations, you know. So that's enlightening to know, you know, there's seven parts of self, another Joe and Charlie line, that everyone has. You know, we're all human beings. And if someone gets too close to that, I'm going to react, you know. And so I got to see that. And it's funny when you write over and over and over again, you know, like, you know, where I'm wrong. You start seeing patterns. And he told me to go down and don't go to the next column until you finish. So it's a repetition. You just, wow, I'm really sensitive. And then the part, you know, where is I at fault? And, I got to see some truth, you know, what did I play, you know? And, in doing that, I got to get some release. You know, it talks about resentment being the number one offender. You know, I can't afford to have resentments to stay sober. You know, and as far as fears, I love it. There's a part in the book that I really relate to. You know, fear is like a corroding thread shot through a fabric of our lives, through our existence. And yeah, fear ran my life. My higher power was fear. You know, fear of what you thought of me, fear of not getting drunk, fear of getting too drunk, you know, is just everything. And so having all this stuff in my mind, I couldn't have a relationship with a higher power. You know, in the last two things, a harms list and, you know, sex relations, you know, I had done a lot of stupid things, that I wasn't very proud of. Even when I wasn't drinking, you know, some embarrassing things, some shameful things. And I listed it all down, you know, and, you know, I had plenty of relationships, but I had no confidence in myself. They were just, you know, there was definitely, you know, jealousy aroused. There was definitely suspicion aroused. And I just learned the truth to myself, and it was humbling. And so I write it all down on paper, and, you know, we set up the time, and I tell this guy, and this is kind of gross, but he laughed out loud in my face when one of my harms was, I put a pimple on someone's toothbrush. That is really gross, but I did that, you know? I was pissed at somebody. but he laughed a bunch of times. He was just like, what is wrong with you? But I felt relief. And he always said, people toothbrush, huh? But it's a joke now, you know, it's not a big deal, you know, that's a pretty embarrassing thing to do, pretty raunchy thing to do, but that, you know, I did that because I thought that was the right thing at the time. And I had this fifth step, and I just let it all go. I just had freedom, you know. I remember, I kind of jumped around a little bit, but New Jersey AA, there's a lot of home groups, visit other home groups that do speaker appointments. I had under 90 days, so I was just moral support. And at the end of one of those things, you know, I remember I had said I would always like look into, you know, self-help books and like try to figure out who I am. I just had a moment of clarity. I was just like, I'm just an alcoholic. I can stop searching. There's no more searching. I'm an alcoholic. That's it. You know, and so I have these experiences and God is showing himself to me. And that, you know, I put this all on paper and all of a sudden that door opens up, you know, the darkness is gone. And, you know, I didn't have a spiritual experience right then and there, but, you know, I'm a different person today from then. So something has happened in my life. You know, and to learn about, you know, having character defects and you know, I can write these things down and And when I'm ready, because a lot of times I like these character defects, they suit me in certain ways, you know, I can manipulate them to my life and have certain outcomes. But when I'm ready and ask God humbly, things, I can change the human being. That's incredible. You know, things could completely lead me from this power. And so, you know, one thing he told me about the higher power was, it can't be you, it can't be human. These things will fail you. You know, and you know, Bill's story, Eddie, you know, tells Bill, figure it out for yourself, you know, find it yourself, make it up, you know? And for me, a higher power is just, if I were to say, it's just love, it's just an experience, it's just something that wants the best for me, it's something I believe in. I mean, you can call it magic if you want, but, you know, I decided to give my will and my life over this thing, and it's worked for 11 years. You know, some amends processes, a really embarrassing amends I had to make was one night I was drunk, and the pimple toothpaste kid I really hated, so I stole a pot from his house, and I would always question my ability to be tough. And so I was like, a tough guy would take this clay pot and throw it at a random car. And so I did, you know, as I'm driving. And it was just a shameful, stupid act. I can't imagine waking up the next day with a pot through my, I don't even know. And, you know, so that was on the amends list. And I had, you know, how do I make amends for that? It's a long, long time ago. And, you know, my sponsor said, well, you gotta do something. And it's probably good to get a check in hand, go over there and go house to house and ask if anyone had a car vandalized. And I didn't do it for a long time, because that was just, yeah, that's really embarrassing to me. So, you know, finally, I do all the easy amends. And I do it, and I, you know, he said, have a check, pay, be willing to pay, you know? And I had it. I didn't have a lot of money at the time, but I was willing to do it, and I went house to house. No one knew. They're like, I don't know what you're talking about. So maybe I was in the wrong block. But one person's like, are you making an amends? And I was like, yeah. And like, oh, someone in my family's in the room. And I was like, oh, cool. And so, you know, that was just a cool little story. And, you know, I mentioned I'd party with my uncles. There's plenty of times I'd run my mouth. I'd run away, and they'd get in a fight for me and get hospitalized. You know, so got one guy, my uncles got knocked out once. You know, he had stitches over his eye and, you know, making those amends to people like that. Like, there's something to say once you own your truth. Once you go through the process and you know you've done wrong and you're honestly willing to let someone know that from the bottom of your heart, you know, you come heart in hand and explain to someone, this is what I've done, and I'm willing to have you tell me more things that I've done if I've missed anything, and stop, they don't know how to take it, you know? I was like, hey, you had insurance bills probably, like, I can pay for that. He's, nah, you know, like... And so some of them are relatively easy, but, you know, he told me, he gave me a little script. He's like, you know, when you're ready, talk to me about it, go up, you know, you don't necessarily have to say you're in recovery, but hey, you know, I'm changing my life right now, and I'm looking at my past, and I've done some things I'm not very happy about. You know, I remember this time, you know, when to do would not injure them or others, of course, this is why you talk to your sponsor. You know, I did X, Y, and Z, you know, and I'm not happy that I did that. I need to apologize for that. If there's anything I left out, please let me know. You know, and just having that dialogue, and, you know, let me know what I can do to make it right, you know? And I go through these spiritual exercises, and not only do I get a relationship with a higher power, but I get freedom for myself. And as a matter of fact, I get more power, you know? And that's part of my spiritual experience. And, you know, steps 10, 11, and 12 is just, for me, getting a higher, closer communication with my higher power, being honest and transparent, with myself and others. You know, today I have to live a life you know, patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. You know, I have to, in all my affairs, try to be the best I can be. You know, be the version of a big book to those people out there. And I'm not always successful. I had gotten into a little arguing match with some guy that was selling me some cactuses. And fortunately, like, in my head now, I feel like, I don't want to make amends. But I want to stick up for myself, I want to set a boundary. But I had to talk to my sponsor about it, and I had an emotional hangover, and it's like, is it worth it? You know, why couldn't you just leave the store and not say, well, what's your whole sell prices for this? You know, like, why are you trying to, just stupidness, you know, ego comes out. You know, ego edging God out, and, I still deal with that, you know. I've had a spiritual experience, I've been sober, I've helped a lot of people, I've done a lot of service. But the ego rebuilds itself. You know, I've done a lot of step work a lot of different times. I get well and I fall asleep, and you know, I have to invite God back in my life. You know, I have to eat crow, I have to, you know, eat humble pie, because I forget. You know, I forget to practice these principles. And unfortunately, I have a design for living in a program that I can just fall back on every single time. It's almost time to wrap up. I just want to wrap up with this service commitment that I'm doing now. And I've done a few. I've been a GSR. I love general service. You learn about traditions and the spirituality of, you know, the traditions that hold AA as a whole together. You know, I had a great time. I was a grapevine rep. I was taking grapevine books to meetings. There's other literature besides conference group literature besides the big book. You know, I've done jails. I took meetings in jails. I've never been to jail, and I was scared every single time I went, but I wasn't working with anybody then. And I was like, oh, maybe this could be an opportunity of service. And I've actually done an AA correction pen pal. I've done step work with somebody literally writing. And those have been really good experiences. I've sponsored a lot of guys. For the last 4 years, I've been on this young people's committee, Bucks County Young People. And, you know, 6 years prior, we were at a dinner. You know, someone had mentioned it. I was like, hey, if you got a start, let me know. And I kept my promise. And I, you know, for 4 years, we bid to get a conference in Bucks County. And you learn about yourself a lot in service. You know, you get a lot of resentments. And when I was really young, there was a Garden State Young People in New Jersey, and they put on dances and stuff, and they had a lot of fun. And I just saw there's something about, you know, they had a happiness, they had a freedom. And, you know, after 4 years, we finally won this conference. And, you know, it requires us to meet a lot of different criteria. You know, we have to go in front of our advisory board and say, hey, this is why we need this conference at Bucks County, because there's a lot of alcoholics here. We need to stay and show that AA is beautiful and recovery is awesome, and we can have a life beyond our wildest dreams. And I'm really excited about it. I'm the program chair. I'm going to put together a crazy program. You know, in the past, they've had, like, you know, blow up, like, water slides, but, like, someone got hurt 1 year, so we can't do that. But, like, you know, I have all these ideas. I want to have, like, this rave that goes to, like, 4 a.m. And, you know, if you haven't been to an AA conference, they're crazy. You know, it's just, like, partying sober. You know, you stay up late. You know, I like dancing. You just rock out. You meet so many people. You face a lot of fears because it is intimidating. There's a lot of spiritual work that goes on there. I just want to mention it because it's a small part of AA that a lot of people don't talk about, and it's changed my recovery greatly. Yeah, it's something you shouldn't miss. So I'll just leave it at that. That's all I got. Thanks.
The group would like to thank Jonathan for sharing his experience.